My name is Tom, and I am an alcoholic. Howdy. The piece of paper says that I live in Berkeley. I actually really live in Oakland and have for some time, but it used to be that if you said Berkeley, it fulfilled everyone's expectations. People get very excited about Berkeley, and now it's kind of fashionable to be from Oakland. And they all want to know where you were on the day of the quake, you know, so I can tell them I was sober. So I noticed the earthquake. I used to think a lot of those things were just me, you know, but it's... Turn it over. I've been here since yesterday evening. I had the pleasure of bringing some folks from Texas to Yosemite for the first time. And it's a thrill for me to be able to experience a place I love through the eyes and hearts of people who've never been here before. We tried to tell Bob M. that those are not hills, they're cliffs. But in Texas, those are hills. It's not that the hills in Texas are so big, they just only have hills in Texas, and anything, it's a hill. So we're expanding his vocabulary. He's 22 years sober, and it's time for his vocabulary to be expanded. What else is true? And today has been a day of listening to some folks talk about recovery and eating and sleeping and pretty much getting ready for tonight. And the best way I can be ready to speak at an AA conference, number one, is to be sober. That's real important. I don't think you should talk at a conference if you've even had a little NyQuil. You know, I think it's a bad policy. And kind of to be here. And I think I really am here. I don't feel frenzied. I'm not at the moment worried about the future, and I'm not bitterly resentful over the past. So it's such a little moment of grace that I'm glad to be talking, because I frequently soar off to the future or the past. Let me see. I got sober somewhere on a Wednesday in the month of August in 1976. I was not expecting to get sober at that time. It just happened. I did not have this planned out. I knew that I had some difficulty with my drinking, and I think I knew that at some time I was going to have to dry out, but I sure didn't expect to do it then. I think I was willing to stop drinking when I reached 65, which is retirement age anyway. And I kind of had the feeling that, oh, I knew I had difficulty with my drinking, but not all the time. And most of the time, I didn't have a problem, and if I could just control those couple of extra times, I wouldn't have any difficulty at all. And I was willing to keep trying to control that stuff, and it didn't. I'm one of those people who was intervened on by people who told me they were friends. I was raised to be polite, and so I did not fight back, but it really scared me. I felt a lot of embarrassment and shame about this. These were people who had known me for a long time, and it was scary for me to have my drinking and my behavior the subject of public conversation. And I was told that I was going into treatment, and I was put into one of these 21-day spin-dry places. And while I was there, there were some good things about it. Number one is they taught us to eat food, which was very important, and I had lost the art. Toward the last while of my drinking, what stayed down was hot dogs and tomato soup. And the nice thing about tomato soup is you did not have to take it out of the can, so it really was a nice efficiency meal. And in the hospital, they tried to reintroduce us to, like, bananas and oranges and salad. I remember, towards the end of my drinking, being genuinely baffled by salad because I didn't know where to start. It was there were so many places you could start, and it took real work to chew it, and it was, and wear, you know, different colors, California after all, and is the avocado garnish. It just really threw me. So I just didn't do that stuff. I tried to do nothing that took effort because I had no energy to do anything other than drink and recover from the drinking and then drink. And anything that was frivolous was just discontinued, like eating. I also had a little difficulty with personal hygiene. Now, this is not the theory of personal hygiene. I'm all for the theory of personal hygiene, but it was exhausting to wash regularly. So I just didn't do it. When I was hospitalized, they encouraged us to do this on a regular basis, and reintroduced us to the notion of soap. I started doing these very simple kinds of things. They told us some real good AA. This was a program that was very strongly oriented towards AA, and the only time they let us out was to go to a meeting, and the only people they let in were folks with some sobriety. And we had two little old ladies. My first exposure to AA in the hospital was two really, really old ladies who came in, and one had a wig that was crooked. I'm nothing if not critical. And they both had quiet voices, and they were polite, and they sat there on like a Thursday afternoon and talked program. And I did not relate, and I felt real sorry for one. Her name was Mary, and she was sober a little while, like months, you know, 6-8 months. And whenever she talked at a meeting afterwards, I'd bump into her, and because we went to similar meetings, and she was always so grateful to be here. And meetings were so important. And be sure and talk to your sponsor, and you'll find an awful lot of good, useful information in the book. I just thought she was brain dead. I really did. This was someone who'd been out there too long. And what I remember as far as getting into recovery, I thought we talked like that in California, into recovery, you know, what are you into, recovery? Being cool was a very important part of my program, and stuff like that wasn't very cool. So I tried doing some of the stuff. They gave tools. The first meeting I went to for myself, it was a Friday night meeting at the central office in Oakland where we have real AA, and I sat down. It was a little discussion meeting, Friday night, old-timers meeting. And everybody in the room was 105, and they were happy, and it was well-lit, and they all drank black coffee and smoked Marlboro Box. It was a strong group identity. And at my first meeting, the topic, I think, was, how was your week? And the speaker said that we all knew his story, and he wouldn't bore us with it, and everyone laughed, and I didn't know what was funny, but I laughed, too, and the next person talked, another male, and he said that he had a real good week and a lot of good spiritual practice, and he got up the energy to cut the front lawn. I did not want what he had. Nor did I have a front lawn, which is very important to say. Right now, I do have a front lawn, and I'm of the studied opinion that if you can cut the front lawn and do laundry on the same day, you get the mental health award for the month. But at that time, I didn't know anything about spirituality. There was a married couple at this meeting, male-female, and they were married to each other. And they were being openly affectionate in a public place with each other. And I hadn't seen anything that strange in years. I was raised, my mom's Swedish Lutheran and my dad's Irish Catholic, so we were not known as being a terribly touchy family. You kind of waved across the room to show intimacy. Unless you had a couple of drinks, you know, then watch out. But anyway, then it was my turn to talk, and I said, "Hello, my name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic." Now, I had said that before. I go to meetings, and there are newcomers, and they haven't said it yet. You know, any newcomers? And they raise their hand, and someone will come and say, "Hi, my name is Sally, and I'm..." And everyone just turns and says, "Come on, Sally," you know. "Sally, if you can say this out loud, the whole world will start to be different." And it you can't force it, you know, and it's right here, stop. And she'll say, "Alcoholic." And we say, "Oh, we're so relieved, you know. Isn't it great? Aren't you glad to be here?" The answer is usually, "No, I'm not glad to be here." Because that sure was that way for me. I was not glad to be at that meeting. But I had said that I was an alcoholic before. I'd seen a therapist. I have seen more than one therapist. And several of them were better than others, and several I got along with better than others. The first one I saw, I was a senior in college, and I went, he was a Southern Baptist Freudian. And interesting tensions. I have them too, I assure you. And we were talking about, why am I so depressed? Because I was in a long line of depression my senior year in college. I was also drinking on a daily basis and smoking non-habit forming dope every day. But we never asked about it, so it didn't come up when we talked about my family for a long time, which depressed me. And I remember at the end of our time together, which was 3 or 6 or 8 months, we concluded that the reason I was depressed was that I was in Spokane, Washington, which is a pretty good reason to be depressed if you've ever been there. And I left Spokane, took the geographical cure, and the depression went away. And I figured, well, that was right. See? So I had a while more of new times, and the depression went away, went back to, started working, and I stayed real busy, and that's one way I can always fight depression, is busy. But this time I was back in school as a student, and I'd been there for a year, and I couldn't shake it. And I went to see a doctor named Solomon, good name, and I wanted to know this time not why I was depressed, but, "Doctor, why is it that I drink like I drink?" Because, see, I only have one goal in my life, and that is to control and enjoy my drinking. And that isn't happening. And it's scaring me, and I drink and sometimes have odd experiences. And we would talk about these. I did not take the 20 questions until I was attending meetings. And when I took the 20 questions, Bob last night mentioned passing very well. I passed pretty well, too. I had about 10 or 12 yeses, and they said, "Well, 3 and you're definitely an alcoholic." And I just found that kind of baffling. And I sometimes I would go, because I couldn't quite get it that I could. I mean, maybe one day I'll be an alcoholic, but I'm bright and I'm going to school, and I've never gotten a drunk driving ticket in my life. I've never spent a night in jail. I did go to San Quentin for a while, but that was as associate chaplain, and that shouldn't count. I was such a bad alcoholic, I didn't even have any tattoos, which is pretty humiliating when you're in treatment and you're the only person there, including the women, who doesn't have tattoos. And you just figure you are such a major sissy, you know, they're never going to let you join this group. Real bad. But I did have some symptoms, and I'd like to just mention a couple of those this evening, just in case there are any doubts. Well, sometimes I'll go around and say to people, "Do you think I look like an alcoholic?" They always say yes. So I don't know why I have to prove that I'm an but I mean just a couple of incidentals in case some of us share, in case some of us have met before, you know, we can meet again. I did have changes in personality when I drank. In pretty orthodox AA, we discussed Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Yeah, I did a lot of that. Dr. Jekyll, by the way, was the good guy. And he played with chemicals and drank some of them and became Mr. Hyde, where he would lurk in back alleys in London and do awful things. I not only had a bad case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I also had a pretty bad case of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And I never knew what would happen when I drank. Sometimes I'd be grumpy and sometimes dopey and sometimes sleepy and occasionally Snow White. It was really a surprise. You know? I did have an amazing capacity to drink when I was a kid, and that was real important. I started drinking when I was young enough to think that mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup was a good idea. Don't judge me. May I suggest that some of you have drunk worse, you know, and a lot more recently. I was a kid. I also liked creamed mint and out of the bottle, and I drank bourbon out of the bottle, I drank creamed mint out of the bottle, and I drank Hershey syrup out of the can. So it was not a lot of social quality to this. But I was pretty young. I know to get to the creamed mint, I had to climb on a chair and reach over the washing machine to get it, so I'm not real old. In high school, booze really worked for me. And that's one of the things to say out loud. And I mean, there was a period of my drinking when it was a lot of fun. And I was fabulous when I drank. Now, I want to say that because I had a lot of insecurities. I was one of those kids who was real bright, but not at all athletic. And at a pretty early age, what I did is I moved into my head. And that was a very safe place for me to stay, and I could read things and learn things, and I just prided myself on having the vocabulary of an adult in the eighth grade. But it was safe for me to go there. What was unsafe was to be competitive or to be physical. And in grammar school where I was, the only playing field was an asphalt track of some kind, and during lunch you had to go and play athletic events. Now, I knew that if I threw that baseball, I would throw like a sissy, like a girl. You know? And like I say, there's survival here, you know? And it's easy to talk about at 42, but when you're 11, it literally is a question of suicide or not. And the way I handled that little crisis is I never threw the ball. And whenever it was a possibility of fate, I just didn't play. And I would retreat into humor, or I'd retreat into my brain, or I'd write another, you know, do something. And I found out that to survive, what I would do is leave for lunch and go home. Both my folks work, and in the seventh grade and eighth grade, I would go home and fix myself lunch and watch Life with Elizabeth, with Betty White, and then have a couple of drinks and go back to school. This is when I tried mixing tequila and milk and vanilla ice cream in a milkshake. And I remember taking a hit out of it and saying, this tastes awful, and then I drank the whole thing. And I think normal drinkers say things like, this tastes awful, and leave it alone, or pour it out, but I knew, you know, value is here somehow, even though it tastes awful. Who has time to taste? One of those occasions, I do not remember leaving the house. I do not remember getting on my bike. I do not remember the telephone pole, or the police or the ambulance. I was taken to the hospital with a concussion, this anonymous kid, you know. I guess they ran fingerprints or bike license and called my mom and she picked me up. I come to the next day and no one knows what's wrong. Because in the late Eisenhower administration, you did not take urine samples from 12-year-old kids to see if they were drinking. It never occurred to anybody. They presumed cancer or a brain tumor, you know, but maybe he just got dizzy. But the reason I want to mention that was my only drunk driving accident. After that, I learned how to do it. It's also the first time I know of I was in a blackout, and this is 7th or 8th grade. So, you know, gee, do you have young alcoholics? Oh, my. I could have been put into treatment right then, but we didn't talk about any of those things, and so the next time I was available to go to treatment, I was 29, so a few gallons of water had gone under the bridge. I was at an AA meeting in Portland, Oregon. It was advertised for young persons, and being that I was not yet 40, I thought I qualified. They were all teenagers. I felt like their grandfather. And I sat down, and the guy chairing talked about drunk driving on his bike. That's what brought that whole memory back to me. More will get revealed. And they said, does anyone have a topic? And they all had topics, and this one kid was just going into junior high that year, and he says, he's entering junior high, and he's paralyzed with fear. He does not think he could get through junior high school sober. No, I didn't. I had nothing to tell. I had no experience, strength, or hope to give this kid. But a 16-year-old said, listen, let's talk. You can do this a day at a time. You have friends, you have program, you have phone numbers. We're going to make this. You know? And I just, you know, what's the most effective tool in people getting sober? It's one of us talking to one of us. You know? And that makes a difference, and it crosses all kinds of strange barriers. Anyway, when I was in high school, I had a tremendous capacity to drink. I was one of those people who put other people to bed. By that time, I had developed a capacity to drink really big fellas under the table, and that was a constant joy to me. These guys who would come in kind of dragging their knuckles on the ground, you know, and they'd have a couple of drinks and throw up and pass out. I thought that was hilarious. And I could just drink it again right out of the bottle and not even break into a nice little sweat. When you have a capacity like that, it's an abnormal sign of drinking. It's like telling someone with tuberculosis that they cough real well. Because normal people are affected by booze, and if you're not affected by booze, something's abnormal. Dr. Gill in San Francisco talks about three distinct phases of alcoholism, the first phase being the fun phase, second phase being fun plus problems, and the third phase being problems. And I want to let you know that's true, and that's my story. I had fun for a long time. I started developing problems, but I still had fun. And I was willing to do it. It didn't have to be fun as long as there was the promise of fun. I'd do it. And then I got to a place where it was just problems, and it stayed that way for a real long time. I didn't have a lot of difficulty in thinking that I had something going on with my drinking. My biggest problem in recovery is the realization and the hope that I can recover. I saw a therapist. Did I mention that already? Saw a therapist, and he said, Tom, there is absolutely nothing wrong with you except for this conviction that there's something terribly wrong with you. But I'm so afraid of lightening up for just a second, you know, I'm being struck down dead. So I figure, well, at least if you're pessimistic, you're usually right. So what's the problem? I sort of developed a sense of doom. At a meeting in Berkeley in the last year, we have a resident depressed person. We have a lot of other depressed persons, but we have a resident depressed person who's kind of like our poet laureate. And whenever you want the group to get depressed, you call on him. And he was talking about his new realization that the sun was going to burn out in 6 billion years. And one of the other guys in the room said, how long? And the guy said, 6 billion. And the other fellow said, oh, thank God, I thought you said 6 million. There's part of me that really fits right in there. I mean, it's that sense of There is no hope, you know, we're just... life is hard, you know, you work hard and it's not fair but fight and there is a kind of embattled sense to it, and I can get into that position real easily. What I was afraid of in early AA, I was afraid to let go of a lot of that hard feeling. I remember it was on Telegraph Avenue. I remember the room clearly. They actually said that if you don't let go of your resentments, you'll never get well. Can you imagine that? Well, I loved my resentments. And I held on to the hatred. And when you said, "Tom, who are you?" what I was able to do was give you a long list of everybody I hated, and that's who I was. On that list were family members, presidents of the United States, some justices of the Supreme Court. It was a very well thought out list. But my fear was that if I let go of that, there would be nothing left of me. And I had this image of being a rice hull blowing around the kitchen. No substance whatsoever, because the only substance that I had was negative and heavy and depressed. When I was in college, let's add this to the fact, I was at least two or three or four different people, and one of me was Good Time Charlie, but I was always afraid of the shallowness of that person. I was so shallow and so vapid and nothing going on, so the only way I could develop any integrity was to work on depression. Because depressed people were deep, and I just thought I would work on that, you know, and that would surely give me credibility. In college, we had to read a lot of philosophers in the seminary, and most of them are dead, and it's kind of a relief they are. They're so glad they can't write anymore, because what they wrote was so long and awful. One that I liked very much was Albert Camus, a Frenchman who had more than one bad day and usually wrote on that day. The one thing he said that it just electrified me, he said that the only serious philosophical question of the 20th century is, why not commit suicide? I thought he had something. I liked that. And I remember just kind of nurturing that, you know, and saying, oh, someone else understands. Because with the problem with good feelings is they leave. But a good depression can stay for months. So which one are you going to trust? You know? So my fear in recovery was that my friend, depressed, heavy, negative, judgmental, harsh, would be let go. And I didn't know what was going to come to take its place. It was very, very scary. And I was afraid to let go of what I knew, or things I didn't know. I wanted some guarantees, you know, and there just aren't any. Except that I had to do something called let go and be willing to recover. Started going to a lot of meetings, and I was glad for that. And it's not that meetings fixed me, but I was very crazy. Now I'm just crazy. Then I was very crazy. And I was very physically agitated. It was hard to sit still. My mind went 1,000 miles an hour. Now, it might only be saying a couple of things, but it's saying them at 1,000 miles an hour. And I would go from subject to subject, and I felt raw, and I felt I was starting to feel feelings, and that was a lot of crisis. And I would go to meetings, and I needed to go to meetings that were an hour and a half long. Because it took me an hour to get there after I got there. And then I could actually listen for the last half hour. But the first hour, I'm still, you know, reacting. And then I finally quieted down enough to be able to listen to the meeting. And then we'd say the Lord's Prayer and back, you know, I would become very, very tense again. There were folks who in Berkeley that first year, Berkeley, El Cerrito, Albany, Oakland, what they'd do after the meetings is they'd go out for coffee or ice cream or both. And I tried that a couple of times, and I didn't have the skills. They were able to have conversations. They discussed how their day went. They discussed feelings. They discussed programs. I had no words. When they would say, "How are you, Tom?" I'd say, "Shitty." Period. And it's hard to really have a conversation when you have a one-word vocabulary. And they all looked graceful and gracious, and I felt friendless and awkward, and I had nothing to say to them. And so it was so difficult to be there, I just didn't go. And as soon as the meeting ended, and when I got sober, meetings started at 8:30, and they were over at 10, and as far as I was concerned, that's the way God liked them. I would drive home, and then I would go out, and I was a barroom drinker a lot for as long as I could, I guess, and I would have this image of myself being lead and bars being magnets, and every so often that magnet would just get turned on. I'd be pulled into this bar, and it's like I didn't even know there was a bar in the neighborhood. I'd find it, and I'd end up in there, and I just couldn't. It was like this craziness, and I did not have the obsession to buy a bottle and take it to my room. My obsession was to go to bars. And some of them were really awful. I loved the ones with sawdust on the floor if a knifing had taken place in the last 8 days. I thought that was a classy joint. I did not like bars with a lot of ferns floating around them. Because I went to bars to drink, and I did not go to be conversational. There's a country western song about the man in the mirror and having conversations. Well, I did some of that. But what I had to do was stay out of the bars. And so I'd leave the meeting, I'd go home, I'd park the car, I would pace up and back and forth on the University of California at Berkeley campus, and they have cobblestones and big buildings and echoes, and I would scream and shout and rant and rave and pace and stamp my feet and take up energy until 2 a.m. when the magnet got turned off. Ah, I could relax and go to my room. Now, I did not know that there were places that had bars open 24 hours. I mean, I'm so grateful. I never would have slept. I was just in New Orleans in sometime in the last few months, and in the French Quarter, open container on the street, there's always someone throwing up. It's very exciting. If I had been there drinking, I would have been dead in 3 months. I mean, I have no question. The 2 a.m. limit gave me some stop to my drinking, and then I would go to a meeting or go back, sleep exhausted, get up and go to a nighttime meeting. I did not know that morning meetings counted. I really didn't. And I did not know that noontime meetings counted. As far as I was concerned, real AA was in the evening. And you just held on. And this is not called being happy, joyous, and free, by the way. I want to make that real clear. But I didn't know how else to do it. I didn't go to a noontime meeting till I was into my second year of sobriety. I was teaching in school in Los Angeles, and I was absolutely screaming, rigid with fear and rage one day, and I had the period after lunch off, and I just left campus and found a meeting on Wilshire Boulevard and hung out there, and it was not awful. So I knew it was possible. So, I mean, my program began changing. I started including more things like noon meetings or morning meetings because of the pain level. It wasn't because I said, gee, I feel good. I think I'll adapt my program to new needs. It was pain was there. How do we respond? So I started going to different meetings, different places. Oh, well, who cares? One of the promises says that, what does it say? I've never really memorized a lot of this stuff because it's written down. It says, we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. That's the first promise that came true for me. And the way it came true is very interesting. I mean, I remember, like I say, this fighting the bars, you know, until 2 a.m., that's very vivid in my early recovery, and I did not have the skills to talk to people about what was going on inside of me. because you need some words to use, and I didn't have them. I was at a meeting in Berkeley one night, and it occurred to me in a moment of grace that it had been weeks and weeks and weeks since I had to pace back and forth on that campus waiting for the bars to close. And it just shocked me. And I suddenly realized that the obsession to drink had been lifted. And it, I mean, I didn't suddenly notice, oh, it's being lifted now. I noticed this was lifted a couple of weeks ago. And I got a little bit of hope, just a little bit. A little bit of hope, because I figured maybe it's possible to not drink. Just maybe, because I just didn't think it was possible. I thought I could put it off. I never stopped forever. I still haven't stopped forever. I don't drink today. But I always thought that my next drunk was inevitable. I was a year or two or three sober. It was in L.A., so at a meeting called Arlington on Wilshire Boulevard Thursday night. I sat in the back. The speaker was talking. I was busy. I had just been to Central Office, and I did phone service for a couple of years on Tuesday nights, every other Tuesday night, with a guy named Tom B. from Pasadena. If anyone knows if Tom B. is still alive, I'd sure like to know. He was a guy that drank himself off the L.A. Times, which took some doing. Anyway, we did every other Tuesday night for about 3 years, answering things at Central Office, and I got there a little early one day, and they didn't need me and so forth, but they did some statistics. And they were doing the statistics about most alcoholics die drunk. Oh, most of them, sure, oh yeah, even though, yeah, a lot of them die drunk, and you know, 1 out of 94 does this, and 18 out of 75 do that, and 12 will vote this. Just crazy things who make those statistics. But the thing I picked up was that most of us die. So that filed away in the brain, and I went to this meeting with this dull Caucasian male speaking. And is that redundant? I sat there, and I was saying, you know, Tom, most alcoholics die of their disease. You're just one of the folks. You have no willpower at all and no program, and you're nuts, and you're full of resentment. You can put off that next drink for another day. You can put off that next drink for a month. You can put off that next drink for a year. If you don't have a drink for 10 years, you'll be 40. And you're going to live to be 80. No one has ever been sober 50 years. You're not going to be the first. Which means you'll be drunk sometime before 50 years are up, and if you're going to be drunk sometime before the 50 years are up, you may as well get drunk tonight. I mean, the logic of that was paralyzing, you know? And I knew enough, and my sponsor repeats this, you know, and he says, do not try to argue with your brain when it's talking like that, because it will win. And I knew I needed to reach out, and I turned next to this guy, who I had a vague knowledge of, and we had very different pasts, and didn't vote for the same people, and he dressed funny. Turned next to this guy, and I said, the speaker's still talking, right? I said, I have to talk to you now, because I froze with fear. And I started telling him what my mind was saying, and as I told him and kind of held this craziness up so that light and air got to it and it healed a little bit, what came through is, we just don't drink today, Tom. That's the key. If you don't take the first drink today, you're not going to get drunk today. And if you don't get drunk today, there's a real good chance you're going to wake up sober tomorrow. Okay? What else do you need to know? Well, what about when I'm 84? You know. Real staying in the now, and it... That was the first time I reached out to somebody while I was in crisis. Because did a lot of this myself, thank you very much. When I was young, I think there's a thing with ducks and chickens, they bond at a certain age, like 8 days out of the egg, they'll think their mother is whoever is closest, you know, they follow you around. There's kind of a special moment of vulnerability. Well, I did that with the Marlboro cigarette commercial. And I was, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 5, but very vulnerable and open. And this tough guy with the mustache was there selling cigarettes. And the message I picked up was that men are like that. I mean, real men are like that. And real men have troubles, too. But when they have their troubles, they hop on their horse and they ride off to the High Sierras and smoke cigarettes and figure it out by themselves. Someone told me the horse was his significant other. I like that. There's a program for that, too. But I mean, that image of, thank you, I'll take care of it myself, really was very hard to break through. And this is over a year of sobriety and meetings, and like I say, 1.5, 2 years, when I first turned to the person next to me while I'm scared and talked about being scared. And I just found that to be a significant moment. I don't remember what he said, but I didn't drink that night. And it wasn't what he had to say, it's that I reached out to somebody. Trust has been a real problem for me. The book says that drinking is but a symptom. Believe that. And one of the you can stop drinking and you still have a lot of things to work on. Once you put the plug in the jug, you can then start working the program. But the program is not putting the plug in the jug, you know. I mean, it's bigger. I was in southern Louisiana a while ago, and they were referring to people who are dry but not sober. And in southern Louisiana, they refer to them as being as dry as a sore throat. I like that, and I've been that. And it's an awful way to live. It's like everything, you may as well be drinking. Everything's sharp and jagged, and you're just nuts! You know... But you're going to meetings. Good. How about working the program? You know you're there when all the people who love you start giving you booze again. Because you were easier to live with when you were emptying the machine gun into the fireplace, you know? Yeah. So it was this whole thing of how on earth a lot of my alcoholism is the refusal or the inability to trust anybody. I mean, I was a very private person. I did not let you in. If we were going to talk, we'd talk ideas. Because that was safe. But I couldn't tell you who I was. I was in L.A. teaching in a school in the middle of town, and I was on the roof of the school with a friend of mine. We were both smoking dope and looking out over Watts, and my friend turned to me and he said, you know, you're really hard to get to know. And I remember looking toward him knowingly, and I smiled a little. I didn't say anything. I had nothing to say, but I kind of said, you know, yes, you know, without words. But the fact, I could have said, you know, you think that I have this great big secret in here that I'm not telling you. The fact is, I don't know what it is either. You know? I mean, I'm as baffled by what goes on inside of me as you're baffled by what goes on inside of me. And how can you share it when you have no idea what it is? Well, I needed some sobriety and some meetings and some steps to start coming up with some of that stuff. Admitting I was powerless, which was kind of a relief, but a little embarrassing, very embarrassing. Coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that was... I had to decide to do that one. I mean, I agreed with it. But that's not what it asks for.
It says to come to believe. I had to show up to believe that, and then turning it over and doing a fourth and fifth step, that inventory and sharing it with somebody. And I chose to share this with my sponsor, the inventory. You don't have to. Even if your sponsor says you have to, you don't. The step says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Some sponsors don't qualify. But I chose to do it with my sponsor because of my problem with trust. I trusted no one. And I had to start trusting someone, and that meant someone has to know where I've been. Someone has to know my behavior. Someone has to know what has gone on in my life. So I did the fourth step, writing about fears and resentments and sexual stuff and finances and you know, things that you'd die if anybody ever knew about. Put that stuff together, and I went and made a date with my sponsor, and we got together, and I read him the stuff. And at the end, he said, "Well, one thing's real clear." Now, I froze. I don't like people for whom one thing is real clear. Like they're morally superior. I am related to people who have a lot of things that are very clear, and I don't like them. And again, the fear just came up, because I knew what he was going to do was take my whole fifth step, summarize it into a couple of sub-points, and analyze me. He didn't. What he said was, "Tom, what's real clear is that both you and I need this program very much." And then he left. I was thrilled to see him go. Now, we did not have a moment of intimacy and bliss then. In fact, he left. I didn't feel this major surge of relief at the end of my fifth step either. I did my fourth and fifth in the most businesslike way I could. And it was just another step. It wasn't the most awful step you'll ever take. No, if it was, it would have been printed in red. It's just another step. And I did it. No, I did not call him the next day. Why? Well, I was afraid that I'd say, "Hi, Terry, it's Tom. Let's get together for coffee. Remember me? We talked yesterday." I was afraid he'd say something like, "Listen, I'm real busy this year." Or he'd say, "Does the Archbishop know about that last scam, you know?" He did not call because he's an introvert and they never call. So we went for months without connecting with each other. I went to meetings and I avoided his favorite little Monday night group in L.A. Who wants to go to there? You'll just see your sponsor. And I did a lot of other stuff, and I just didn't know how, because I didn't know if I could trust him. What does it mean for me to trust somebody? I had to think about this. And it's this, that I can tell the other person anything. And number one, it's not going to get around town. I mean, that's just crucial. That's how you get in the door. You know it's not going to be mentioned later. Now, if your family is a little crazy, this is a whole new experience for you. Because in crazy families, today's confidence becomes tomorrow's ammunition, you know? More than once have I had friends that I have told things to and they've gotten back. So the way you deal with that is you tell no one anything. So that's it. The confidentiality is absolutely vital. Number two, I need to know that he is not going to run from me in horror. I was in England a couple years ago. Went to a meeting and I met a Scotsman named Danny. Danny or Donnie, I never quite got. Donnie is the way he pronounced it. And we talked story and talked program, and he had an awful life and did awful things and had a family and abandoned them and beat up his kids, and he was not a nice man. And he tried getting well a lot of different ways, and he went to churches and would join churches and join, you know, moral rearmament groups, and everything would get just fine until they asked him to say, "And Danny, what have you been doing for the last 20 years? And then he'd tell them and get thrown out. you know, because I didn't want this kind of a pervert, this kind of a psychopath in the group. So he's driving, it's raining in London, he walks by, and he walks, there's a little AA meeting going on, and there's this very prosperous-looking Englishman with a cigar standing in the doorway, kind of looking like Winston Churchill. It was not Winston Churchill. But he was standing there, and Dan Wathiney said, it's an open door, and they say they help folks. And he said, listen, I want to talk to you, but before I go inside, I want to tell you who I am. And he just kind of did a little fifth step right there with the guy before he went into the meeting. And he mentioned the child abuse and the this and the that and the awful and the crazy and the stealing, the whole list. And then he said, so I guess you're not going to want me. And this very, very prosperous, prominent, dignified looking man with a cigar stretched out his hand and said, welcome, brothers, so have we all. And you find out that in recovery, we identify, we don't judge. And that makes a different world. Well, I didn't know about that with Terry. And I thought, if I'm going to trust somebody, I need to know they're not going to run from me in horror. Also, I need to know they're not going to run up to me with 700 books I really should read, a lot of pamphlets, and some very good advice. But they will accept me as I am. Well, 6 months after I did my fifth step, Rabbi Joseph Magnin was the rabbi of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in downtown L.A., which is a very prominent synagogue. And every year he would do a Passover service for non-Jewish clergy, kind of an ecumenical gathering, and people would pray a little together and be social and meet together, and the rabbi would explain Passover. I never go to things like that. I was there. My sponsor never goes to things like that. He was there. I walked up to him, said hello. He did not run from me. He did not give me advice. He simply said, I'm glad to see you. And we reconnected. And I suddenly discovered, at 2.5 years clean and sober, 10 zillion meetings later, and having done steps 1 through 7, there was finally someone on this planet I could trust. And it wasn't that he wasn't trustworthy. I was the one who couldn't trust. And the healing was taking place over time. 2.5 years. I think I'm one of the fast ones there. Because I know a lot of us find it very difficult to trust anybody. We know we'll be betrayed. We know we'll be ridiculed. This was a real big one for me. If you knew who I was, you might not turn me into the police, but you would laugh at me. And ridicule was one of the control things we used at home and at school, and it's one of the most awful things I'd ever been through. And I never wanted to have to face ridicule again. Joining AA has been such a different experience where, by and large, we don't treat people like that. I went to a meeting a while ago, and it was in Stockholm, Sweden, and a woman came in, and she was an American tourist. She was having a very bad day, and I had a great big Al-Anon slip, and I gave her advice she did not ask for. But I needed to fix her right away, because she was only going to be in Stockholm a couple of days, you know, and I wouldn't have another chance. And I ended my advice by telling her, listen, keep coming back, it gets better. And she squared off and said, we don't say that in New York. I said, what do you say in New York? She said, in New York we say, keep coming back. First it gets better, then it gets worse, then it gets real, then it gets different, then it gets real different. And that is my experience. Lots of things are real different these days, and I find that to be a good experience. I used to think that if you were real spiritual and working a good program, rules didn't apply to you. You did not have to not park in handicapped, you know. it was a crime if you had to stand in line at Safeway. And I find, you know, if you're really spiritual, you don't sweat. If you're really spiritual, you don't have feelings. You're just grateful. I find spiritual, you get feelings. And you get to follow all the same rules other people get to follow. Couple things about that, and this is current experience. I continue to have drinking dreams. And I want to say that out loud because sometimes I get troubled by those. Not all the time, but kind of regularly. And I was ashamed of it. Because, I mean, you know, all of us have read the National Enquirer and what dreams really mean. And I was figuring, gee, if I'm still having drinking dreams, there must be something I haven't worked through. Well, I asked my sponsor about this finally, and what he said, and I think this is valid, is this. He said, Tom, people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, did you ever have a drinking dream while you were drinking? So I want to say that out loud. And I also, with some regularity, think of drinking. I mean, it's on my brain a lot. It's one of my first thoughts. At the slightest inconvenience is I will have a lot of booze. I attended a conference in San Diego. This was several years ago, and they were talking about street drugs. And they were talking about, there was a new form of cocaine was just coming in. I've never done cocaine. My sponsor always encourages me to put yet on that. I haven't done cocaine yet. But it was this cocaine that was just really dynamite and explosive and wild and hundreds of times more exciting than normal cocaine, whatever that's like. But it was altered, and even though you would have a completely stunning 12 hours and you would feel like you were God, you would get Parkinson's disease from this. And they were finding people in their 20s showing up at the clinics with Parkinson's disease, and they traced it back to this cocaine. All right, they gave us that whole story. All I could think of was 12 hours as smart as God. Now, this is a sign of severe brain damage. And it was obsessive, you know, I just kept on thinking about it all the time. And Parkinson's, that's next year, now, you know. I had to talk to this person next to me who had less time than I did. Very humiliating. And talk about the obsession. And say, this is going on. And again, if I hold it up to light and air, it lessens in power. You know, and I'm able to be there. But I can't say that. I'd be too embarrassed. Then you'll die. they say that anger is the great killer of alcoholics. That may be true, but if anger is number one, embarrassment's number two. A lot of us would rather die than be embarrassed, and I find there are times in recovery where embarrassment is the difference between life and death for me, and that's very, very complicated sometimes. But the thought of having a drink, and when I think about having a drink, I talk about it. I have an ongoing thing with a lot of my friends about this. And it's not like, oh my God, your program must really be bad. No, it's I'm an alcoholic, and one of the regular things I think about is getting loaded on a pretty regular basis. And so what I try to do is on a daily basis, when I am conscious first thing in the morning, I ask God to keep me sober that day. I tell him I'm willing to cooperate. I hope. But God, keep me sober today. And at the end of the day, I say, God, thank you for keeping me sober today. And I try to live right there. And I try to keep it real fresh. Friends of mine will ask sometimes, how are you, Tom? And I'll say, sober. And they'll say, is that all? And I want to say, is that all? I could make you real grateful that I'm sober today, you know? It's real good, you know? I try to be conscious. So then, of course, you have to have a program. And when I first, in AA, and we're guilty of this, we do use buzzwords. You know, at least at some meetings I go to. I went to one meeting in a certain city in California who will not be named. Which will not be named? Noon meeting. So you knew I was just nuts. And anyway, the guy talking said, well, you know, one day at a time I turn it over and I have trouble with God, but easy does it, live and let live and think, think, think. And I wanted to say, all of that's true, but who are you? You know? I mean, you haven't told me anything about you yet. And I need to know that. I need to know what you do, what you think, what you feel, how it operates. Don't just give me the jive, you know. I need something that's real. I need something that has flesh and blood to it, or I'm not going to stay here. I've got to go where I can connect with women and men who should be dead, who are alive, however, one day at a time, and a little surprised by it. And then I can be there. That was going to go somewhere, and it just disappeared. Oh, friends, I guess, saying, you know, are you sober? And I say, yeah. I am always genuinely surprised to not be drunk somewhere. I'm amazed. I am stunned that I haven't peed on myself in years. Years! I'm amazed. I mean, there are all these things that were kind of a regular part of the dance, and I just haven't had to do them. So I'm always kind of amazed to be present. And program, developing a program, what's your program? Well, I hear, again, the AA jargon, people saying, oh, it's a great program. I always want to say, yeah, but what do you do? Well, here's what I do. Like I say, when I am first conscious in the morning, I ask God for help that day. And that I have not been doing for years. I've been doing that for months. My sponsor's been doing it for years. He's sober almost 20 years. It occurred to me 6 months ago that maybe he knows something. Maybe. So I do what he does in some areas. So I do that. And I asked him, I said, well, what should I do? How should I work all this out? There are so many things to do. And he said, how's this? Go to meetings. Shake hands. Take your turn. Take how many hands? Some. Doesn't have to be all of them, but just don't sit there as an observer. Hi, I'm just visiting. Shake hands, say hello, and take your turn. Well, what's your turn? Well, it's different things, but Tom, if you don't participate, you'll die. So I went to a meeting a while ago. I usually feel connected in meetings, but not always. I do bump into people who say they've never been to a bad AA meeting. I always want to say, come around with me, baby. I'll show you some bad AA meetings. Yeah. Oh, well. Anyway, I went to this one meeting, and I didn't connect with anybody. They were all a lot younger than I was, and it was kind of a young and restless crowd, and the hormones were soaring. And it was kind of, you know, dating game and the young and the restless, but not drunk at the moment. And it was working for Hooray, I'm glad for you, but I didn't connect, which said a lot about me. I think I was hungry. I think I was angry. I think I was lonely. I think I was tired. And a little cranky. So but I knew that I shook a couple of hands. Hello, hello. They didn't really shake back very sincerely. And I began developing a little attitude, and I knew I had to participate in this meeting in some way. And what I did is at the end of the meeting, I helped stack chairs. It was participating in the meeting, and no one ever stacks chairs. You know, it's one of the jobs you can always get at an AA meeting. You can help set up, you can help break down, and the participation is crucial, because I have to be a member here. And I have to continually tell that to myself. When I came in, I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. And I thought that if you knew me, you'd throw me out. And that I was less than. As you know, there are two kinds of arrogance. There's the kind of arrogance that says, I am much better than you. Therefore we have nothing in common, and I'm alone in my room isolated. Or there's the kind that says, I'm much worse than you. therefore we have nothing in common, and I end up isolated and alone in my room. And in both circumstances, I'm dead, but my kind of arrogance is part two. It's that I'm just not quite well put enough together to make the team, thank you. So I was at a meeting in my first year of sobriety, and grace worked. I suddenly looked around the room and noticed that everybody in the room, the first thing I noticed was that I was not the only person in the room. This was a shock, because I've always been the only person in the room. You know? I mean, I've always been the only one that counted, the only one that thought, the only one, I mean, just that delicious uniqueness. But I realized that I was not the only person in the room. And number two, the realization that everybody in the room had a right to be there. And that I was in the room. And I had a right to be there too. As much as any other woman or man. And the great thing I heard, and I hold on to this because I think it is so true, the highest rank you get in AA is sober. You know? And we don't do this other stuff. There are times when I am in desperate need of you listening to me, and there are times when I'll listen to you, and we trade that off. The hat goes back and forth. And I do that with some of the people I sponsor. Sometimes they call and they think they have a problem, and I'm the one with the problem. I get to go first. And then we can talk about them, you know. I do not understand God's will a lot. I want to say that out loud. I do not have it reduced to 25 words or less. I do not know what's best for you, and I regularly do not know what's best for me. And the way I perceive things, this is not a nice, neat world. I think there's a lot of unfair, and I think there's a lot of unjust, and I have a lot of anger about that. And I get to work a program on a lot of that. The reason I turn a lot of things over is because there are so many things to turn over. And I find sober I can hurt, and sober I can grieve, and sober I can be angry, and sober I can be in connection with you. A friend of mine, last month I lost two friends, one to AIDS and one to liver cancer, both men my age. And I've known each of them for a while, and it's been a good connection. And I was with one the day before he died, and we spent time and prayed and held each other. And the other 2 days before he died, and we spent time and prayed and held each other. And it was awful. It was just awful. And I find that since I knew both of them had gotten sick, one longer than the other, the way I've handled that is by getting real busy. Because I don't want to feel the anger, and I don't want to feel the grief, and I don't want to feel the hurt of it. But in recovery, I find out what I can do is feel some of the hurt and learn from the experience, and I get to be there without giving a lot of platitudes. But just to say, this is one of those real situations. My friend Mike H., who got diagnosed with AIDS 2 years ago, I was sober 10 years, he said that, he taught me a lot, although I was 6 crucial months more sober than he. We talked about the third step for a while, and he said, you know, I used to think I knew what turning it over one day at a time meant, and then I got my diagnosis. Because I was turning it over one day at a time, figuring I was going to live to be 75. Now I get to turn it over one day at a time because I do not know what happens next. And that's very real. And what I find in loving and doing some work with dying persons is that all the bullshit goes away. And that's real important to my recovery. And so when I get to hurt, I get to hurt. And I get to experience the things that healthy women and men experience, and that's not always wonderful. Sometimes it's awful. And as my friend Bobette says, when you get sober, you feel better. You feel everything better. And none of us are exempt from that. And I find that important to say out loud because I need to let me know that. I need to know that I can cry, and I need to know that I can be there, and I don't have to run from something just because it scares me or just because I don't like it. And I really do see that the whole world is charged with the grandeur of God. But I need you to remind me of that on a regular basis. One of the things about my brain damage is I do not remember much for long. And I need to go on a regular basis where people talk about basic stuff. And when people talk about basic stuff, I can relate. Someone told me that advanced recovery means working the basics. I just think that's true. Real basic stuff. I'm powerless over alcohol. I still am. And I need, and I cannot get well by myself. Crucial. The importance of going to meetings. The importance of having a sponsor. I don't have to like him all the time. That's a great relief, by the way. But I've got to connect with him on a regular basis. And I find that every so often I'll be doing something and this little voice will go off and say, don't tell your sponsor this. It will just worry him. And I have to tell my sponsor that stuff. I mean, that's a very good sign that you need to make a phone call. And I find I can do that, but it's a little difficult sometimes because it's embarrassing to say, well, it's going on again. And I'm grateful he's never said, well, I thought you'd be better by now. He's never thought, I'll be better by now, you know. The best program or the best piece of advice I ever got, and it wasn't my first meeting, was from a very large man named Gary. And Gary said two things. Number one, he said, go to lots of meetings, don't drink in between meetings, and don't use no dope. I'm eternally grateful to him for that, because that was my program for my first year. And then he also talked a little bit about try not to get too hungry, too angry, too lonely, or too tired. What I'll do is say, being that I am now over 10 years sober, I don't need to eat. I don't need to take time off. I don't get angry anymore. And lonely, oh, I'll let my sponsees call me and we'll talk. I set myself up for some very weird stuff when I do that. And again, I'm part of the human race. I need to take care of the hungry, take care of the angry, take care of the lonely, take care of the tired, because no one else is going to do it. And I need to have that directly in front of my face on a regular basis. I was doing a lot of stuff a while ago when I ended up at the Denver airport. And I was hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And my plane was late. I hate the Denver airport. It's an awful place. Yes, you've been there, you know. Everyone I hate has a booth and they're handing out literature. So I sat down in the smoking section. I am a non-smoker, but I sat down in the smoking section in frustration. And I sat next to this huge, fat man who was smoking cigarettes without filters. And I wanted to crawl up on his lap and eat his cigarettes. This is a 10-year sober, mind you. I'm not talking about, you know, 4 days off booze. But I have been given some training. Number one, you have not been introduced, you know. Do not introduce yourself this way. Number two, if you want a cigarette, you can buy a carton. You know? Well, then I thought, no, you can buy a pack. And I said, listen, Tom, if you still want to smoke tomorrow, smoke tomorrow. Okay, relax. Within 10 seconds, the next thought was, there is an attractive bar there. You could have a couple of brandy and sodas. Number one, who would know? Number two, you're in a foreign state. Number three, you've never been drunk on brandy and soda before. Therefore, you probably won't get drunk on it this time. I mean, very clever. As you can tell, I've been to college. And I was able to just, you know, put it off till tomorrow morning. All right, fine, if you want to drink tomorrow morning, but don't do it today. Just don't do it today. That relaxed. 10 seconds later, my next thought was, Tom, you could just go to the men's room and hang yourself. I I'm one of those people who still think about hanging myself. I don't do it because I do believe in an afterlife, and so for me, suicide is just a geographic. And you'll still be mad when you get there, you know, just... So, however, what I've learned is that when I start thinking about killing myself, it is a sign that something's going on. Now, I don't know what's going on yet, but I know something is. And what I had to do, I didn't know, the thing I didn't know is I did not know that you could use the phones in the airport to call people. I only thought I could use the phone in my house to call people. So you do learn more if you show up for meetings. And I had to go home and call, and I said, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm thinking, and they would say, describe your last 2 weeks to us, and they would say, well, it sounds like a good case of hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Now that means I have to take action. I just can't say, oh, thank you, I understand it. As someone said, this is not a program of understanding, this is a program of action. My sponsor had the nerve to tell me on one occasion that it does not say in chapter 5, here are the steps we discussed. Here are the steps we evaluated. You know, it's here are the steps we... What I want to do is understand them, then take them. Which is one reason why I have gone through them so slowly the first time. Because I don't think you understand them until you've been through them a couple of times, and even there your understanding is... I mean, you know, it is a program of action. Tom, do something. Which brings us to step 3 in the end. I don't know how people do the third step a lot. I don't know how people do the 11th step a lot. What I do believe is there are lots of ways of doing this. A friend of mine is a priest in Portland, Oregon, and he is having someone teach him how to pray. I think that's wonderful, and I think we all are learning how to pray, 11th step stuff. And so Steve tells me what he learned. And he said that his spiritual director tells him that one way he could use to meditate and pray is before you sleep at night, just sit with a lit candle for a while, like about 15 minutes, just be there and pay attention. I said, pay attention to what? Well, whatever. The candle, the day, do the 10th step, check your breathing, do a little mantra. And there's a lot of stuff you can do, but do it with a lit candle for 15 minutes before you go to sleep. So I thought I'd try it. Lit the candle, lights out, before I go to sleep. It was the longest 15 minutes of the month. And I can't tell you how busy I suddenly got. My mind took off at 90 miles an hour. This is 11:30 at night. There were people I had to call on the phone then. There were letters I had to write. There were weeds in the garden that had to be pulled. And then I started noticing that the room needed to be vacuumed. Which for me is the extreme point of... And again, like... When I think about hanging myself, I know that something's going on. When I think of vacuuming, I know I'm avoiding something. And it was, what I wanted to avoid was being there in the presence of the higher power and me. And what I need to do is be here. How do you turn it over? Well, what I do is this. I try to show up. Woody Allen says that 80% of life is showing up. I think that's 80% of recovery. I do not do this in isolation. I have to be showing up to connect with you on all kinds of ways. I need to go to meetings. That's the showing up. I need to go to work. That's the showing up. I need to show up to relationships with my friends. That's the showing up. I need to show up to pray. That's the showing up. I need to show up to be inside of my own skin here and now, present. That's showing up. When I've shown up, I have to pay attention. And I've shown up to lots of places and I haven't paid attention. I've been so busy. In fact, I did a wedding once I don't remember. And this is sober, but I didn't want to be there, so I wasn't. Those are still legal, but I mean, I'm there, you know, but I'm not there. I didn't want to say no, you know, I'd hurt their feelings, so I just went away. Very crazy. I need to be present, I need to show up, and once I've shown up, I need to tell the truth. This does not mean I need to take an ad out in the New York Times. It does mean I need to tell me what's going on. If I'm feeling grief, if I'm feeling anger, if I'm feeling fear, if I'm scared, if I feel close, if I feel awkward, I need to be able to let me know what's going on and share that with some folks. And I find that if I can trust one person, I can trust more than one person. And you start getting very interesting, the people you trust. And what's last? Oh, if I show up, pay attention, and tell the truth, I get out of God's way. And then God can do with me whatever God wants to do with me, which is none of my business. You know, I always thought it was my business. I was writing my biography as I lived it, which is the reason I got so little done. Other people can write the book. My job is to show up, pay attention, and tell the truth, be present here, and have the grace to fall in love a lot with women and men who are in my life. That used to embarrass me to tears. If I fell in love, what did it mean? How does this work? I am graced with being able to fall in love a lot with women and men, and it greatly enriches my life, and it doesn't scare me nearly as much as it used to. But it's scary, you know. I mean, anything new is scary, and any change is scary. But the good news is we get to do this together, and we get to do this today, and that's what's real. And a lot of us got to do this in Yosemite all day today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.